All right, so we are on Isaiah 30 here. It's already the ninth day of January. Man, I don't know what's going to happen with 22 because 21 just disappeared like poof. But like, I was in a meeting the other day, like a really important government meeting. And the lady kept saying that last year was 2020. Like, she kept using 21 dates. It was like, I realized that that year just disappeared. But she's like, so hopefully everything will be, you know, better next year, you know, in 22. So nobody believes that it's 2022 right now. It feels like 2021. It feels like 2020 near the beginning. Maybe we could skip this whole last couple of years and just keep on going like 2019. But anyway, this is the ESV, this archaeology one, and this is New King James, which says, "Woe to the rebellious children," and this one says, "Ah, stubborn children," and this says the Lord, and this says, "Declares the Lord." So there's not a dramatic difference there, but it's starting out with who he's addressing, which is the rebellious or stubborn, obstinate. Evidently, there's a lot of possible adjectives for these guys. Children who take counsel, but not of me, and who devise plans, but not of my spirit, that they may add sin to sin, who walk to go down to Egypt, and have not asked my advice to strengthen themselves in the strength of the Pharaoh, and a trust in the shadow of Egypt. And the reason I want to start off so strong with that is because what's going on? If you were in Israel, or the Holy Land, or the kingdom, and this enemy was coming, and this enemy was gigantic, scary, the Assyrians, the way the enemies come from those big imperial nations of the Mesopotamian river deltas is they come around the north. So they go up around the Fertile Crescent, because it doesn't really help you to cut through. First of all, you don't need that land. It's basically useless desert. There's not a lot of spoils or things to capture there. Not a lot of people live there. So what they'll do when they do some kind of conquering adventure coming out of Mesopotamia, so it takes sort of the same direction that Abraham took when he left. And he left and went through all of that and all around the Fertile Crescent and came down into the Holy Land. And that's exactly what's going on. So the guys from the north, which we've already talked about many times, in Aram Damascus, which is Syria, and the northern kingdom, have tried to make deals with them and work with them because they're coming through there. Why am I explaining all that? Well, you guys know all that. But that's because they're being attacked from the north. If that was happening, one of the first things you would think of was Egypt. Because Egypt is to the south and slightly to the west. It's the other direction. And it's pretty much the most powerful empire of history. It's true that Babylon and Assyria were as powerful or more powerful, but the ancientness of Egypt will always keep it special. For instance, currently, as we sit here today, the only surviving member of the original wonders of the world from the ancient world is the Great Pyramid of Giza. And several of the other wonders of the ancient world were interconnected to Egypt. Now, obviously, one of them was Babylon, the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, which is fascinating because we're not there yet in this particular place. So it's kind of get your head spinning a little bit. But Daniel, who's the prophet after Isaiah, after they're taken away by the Babylonians, when Daniel's alive is when the Babylonian gardens exists. So Isaiah is coming right before those gardens. So Babylon has risen in the ancient past, fallen, become a bunch of little random kingdoms, then been retaken over and reorganized by the Assyrians and by the time of Isaiah. Those Assyrians are about to take over Syria, there in Damascus, and then down into the northern kingdom, and they're about to come and attack Jerusalem. And that's pretty unstoppable when it comes to the current state of Jerusalem. I mean, they're still a kingdom. They still have armies and stuff, but it's nothing like it was back in the time of David. And even David's army might have trouble against some of these larger empires. So what you would think is, okay, who can we have allies with? Who can we ally ourselves with that's going to protect us from this massive empire? Another massive empire, probably somebody that would like to have this land, and probably somebody from the other direction. And immediately, people began to think about going out and talking to the pharaohs, going out and talking to Egypt and saying, hey, can you guys send some armies up here to help us? So this is a very logical as well as politically sound concept. Unfortunately, it misses the whole point again. And the point is, God is continuing to say, hey guys, he's like waving from heaven. I'm God, I'm right here, and I created everything. I can solve all your problems. All you got to do is turn to me. Stop trying to figure it out yourself. I was thinking this morning when I got up how basically every problem in my life, give or take the whole history of it, has been me trying to solve it myself and turning into something else weird, like I'm trying to solve whatever problem. And I didn't know necessarily most of the time. Nowadays, I'm better at recognizing these kind of things. Back then, I didn't really know. I would just do whatever. And the decisions that I would make without consulting God tend to mess up and tend to cause trouble. And then God tend to have to come around the backside later and fix everything or make everything go the direction it needs to go. And this is what they're doing. They're thinking about, hey, let's go get Egypt, have them help us out on this big problem, you know. But that's not going to work. And he mentions the shadow of Egypt. And think about that for a second, because where we sit in time, now, of course, God has infinite knowledge and timelessness, and we have basically only hindsight. But if we look at the history of the world, Egypt is not completely over, but basically over. But the place in which Isaiah is sitting is very weird, because Egypt has been in power for thousands of years. When someone needs to run and hide, Abraham runs and hides in Egypt. Joseph and Mary and their baby Jesus run and hide in Egypt. Egypt's always been like this superpower. Now Egypt is on the way out. This is around 700-ish, give or take, BC. It won't be long before the Assyrians run everything. And then it won't be long before the Babylonians run everything. And then the Babylonians are the ones that are in power, the Persians of this region kind of unite and become the Persian Empire. And the Persian Empire is sort of a combination of Assyria and Babylon and all of it. And they're the ones in power trying to get into Europe, trying to get in through Greece, which is what Thermopylae in the 300 is about. And then the reaction to that is this defense of basically Europe, but a defense of Greece, which is going to lead us to a king named Philip, and then his son, who's named Alexander. And they're going to destroy the Persian Empire and Hellenize everything from like France to, you know, Egypt to India, the borders of India. That model's going to be copied by the Romans as it fades out because Alexander dies, everything splits up. The Hellenization, the Greek system begins to fade out, but that's why the New Testament's written in Greek mostly, because everything's been Hellenized before all the people in the New Testament are born. That's the intertestamental period. By the time we get to the New Testamental period, you know, we have John the Baptist, etc., and Greece has already come and gone. So Greece is the dominant force of the intertestamental period, Alexander the Great. And then Rome rises, and Rome's in power. By the time John the Baptist and Jesus are born, Rome's in charge. The pharaohs, starting with Alexander, the Ptolemies, which are Greek. So starting with the whole, you know, the whole Cleopatra thing. So basically what I'm trying to say is Egypt, right around the time of Isaiah, is done being a great, all-powerful empire of the ancient world. And the turning to them, in hindsight, historically, archaeologically, turning to them is futile. Not just, God obviously is God. I'm talking about historicity here. It's futile because they're not going to be able to take on the Assyrians, and then especially not the Babylonians. So the Persian Empire, I mean, they're going to be swept through by everyone from now on. Egypt. Alexander's not even going to have to fight to take over Egypt. They're just going to give up Egypt. They're just going to give it to him. So Egypt is not what it was. So that's what this means by the shadow. Of course, Isaiah has no way of knowing that, right? He's just talking like from a God perspective, which has all this knowledge that no one else has. For all they know, Egypt's always been super powerful. For all they know, Egypt will rise to be the greatest power in the world again, you know, in the near future, but it won't. So they're turning themselves to something that looks powerful. This is a lesson for us, right? They're turning their attention to something that looks powerful to help them, but it's not. Therefore, this is 3. Therefore, the strength of Pharaoh shall be your shame, and trust in the shadow of Egypt shall be your humiliation. For his princes were at Zoan, and his ambassadors came to Hanes. They were all ashamed of a people who could not benefit them, or be help or benefit, but a shame and also a reproach. So, what's happening is this humiliation that is related to looking to others to protect you, and then you're not only doing that, but you're looking to others that can't protect you. So the theory is, and we think it's true, but I don't 100% know for sure, but the theory is they had sent ambassadors already into these locations in Egypt to go and speak to Egypt and try to get Egyptian help. Which is fascinating, because not only can they not help, but that shouldn't have been the plan. The people of God should just be the people of God. They shouldn't be the people of make a deal with Arab Damascus or make a deal with Egypt. But this is kind of giving us insight into Egypt, insight that Isaiah himself, as a regular human person, could not have possibly known. That's why the other people are going to Egypt to ask for help, because no one knows that Egypt's basically done. But in 6, the burden against the beast of the south. The burden against the beast of the south. So this is, you know, referring to this interconnectivity with Egypt, which we've already talked about in earlier sections. Through a land of trouble and anguish, from which came the lioness and the lion, the viper and the fiery flying serpent. People love that, because that like seems to be evidence of dragons. There's several references to fiery flying serpents in the Bible. And everybody's like, see, it's right there, dragons. Maybe it is. I don't know what a fiery flying serpent is. They will carry their riches on the backs of young donkeys. I know what a donkey is. So there's some in Cripple Creek. Probably not a dragon in Cripple Creek, although there might be. And their treasures on the humps of camels, to a people who shall not profit, for the Egyptians shall help in vain and to no purpose. So the reason we shift gears and we say the burden against the beast of the south, and then we shift gears to through a land of trouble and anguish, that's that language we've been talking about since the very first day of this class a year ago. We're talking about that poetic, prophetic language. So Isaiah will say, and then John said to Sam, hey, come over here and get me some coffee. And then he'll shift gears into the wind blew across the plains as the great eagle. Okay, and you know what's going on. It's like language. And so it shifts into sort of a mode. So right here in this first section, we have three different types of language. We have this, woe to the rebellious children, says the Lord. So we have this, him writing down a very direct set of like prose instructions from the Lord. And he's talking about the ambassadors and the location and things like that. And then we have this adjustment of the language. So this is the burden or the prophecy against what you're trying to do. And then we shift into this, the land of trouble and anguish from which came the lioness and the lion, which is this sort of, you know, more poetic, prophetic language. And does anyone else know what a fiery flying serpent is, unless it's a dragon? I'm just saying, maybe that whole thing about St. George killing the last dragon, maybe that's real. I don't know. There could have been. I don't have a lot of archaeological evidence for dragons. But who knows? Maybe somebody has misidentified a dinosaur skeleton. See? Like, what is this section for? Well, that would be the fire generation sack. Anyway, that hasn't happened. That's just in my mind. Okay. But someday. Anyway. The whole getting help from Egypt thing is not going to work out. Now, what's fascinating about this chapter is how dramatically long it is, okay? So this chapter, we've had chapters that are like this long. This one's like 3 pages. So what's he doing in this chapter? Why is this chapter so long? It's because he's dealing with sort of the final look at what's wrong with the way you guys are living. And what's wrong with the way you guys are living is you're trying to do it on your own strength, and you're trying to rely on the people around you. And we've been talking about this now for almost 30 chapters. And chapter 31 is going to be basically how foolish it is to not just trust in God. And then there's going to be a section about what's, you know, sort of coming. And then we're going to get to the actual story of the physical activities of what happened, which starts in like 36. So now it came to pass in the 14th year of King Hezekiah that Sennacherib, king of Assyria, that's 36. So what we're doing is we're finishing up this whole first section, which has been dealing with all of the people around them. And the groundwork being laid there is, having done that, having seen what all the different kingdoms around you amount to, and how they fall apart and fail, and all these other things, having seen all that, and having the biggest threat that's come upon you since the establishment of the kingdom coming now, why would you then just turn to those guys? Like, you're missing it. So this kingdom's been around for over 300 years, approximately. So this whole idea, it was really great around 1000-ish B.C. So it was really great. So that's when David and Solomon were around. And there was about 100 years of real awesome sauce. And then it starts to fall apart. But you still have periods where the north and south are great. So you've been around as a kingdom or kingdoms 300 plus years. You know, and the whole point of it has been over and over again, God, why now? You know, why now are you turning, you know, not paying attention? And they really haven't, I mean, basically ever paid attention, but whatever. Therefore, I have called her Rahab Hemshabeth. So what that means is, in other words, you have this Egyptian section that you're turning to, and the word Rahab means storm or arrogance. So now we get some of this poetry, because Rahab was the name of a dragon. See, I thought I was just talking about dragons. It was a dragon from pagan mythology from the region. And so we're connecting those dots. So this is poetic language. But we've now seen both Rahab and Leviathan. What we tend to see when we see Rahab and Leviathan, so Leviathan is a great beast of the sea. Rahab is a great beast of the air and fire. Are they based solely in mythology? Are they based in something real? We would be back into several thousand BC to figure that out. And that might not be something we can exactly figure out. But in our case, they're symbolic, because they represent forces of the earth, forces of the world, forces of these other kingdoms, forces of pagan kingdoms. Pagan kingdoms tend to use symbols like dragons or great beasts or powerful things, lions, because they're representing their power. So in a less mythological way, think of it like lions representing power on the earth, right? Lions are one of the biggest, most powerful creatures that we have. Definitely one of the most legendary type creatures that we have. And so if you had a lion head on your head, or you had a lion on your shield, it would be a representation of your power in the world. These are like ramped up mythological versions of that. Because if there was a dragon, a lion wouldn't be that big a deal, right? And this is why these symbols are so important. Because what happens to all of the dragons and the lions? A lamb conquers them. So this is the ultimate switch psychologically. This is why Jesus is such a big deal. This is why the Jewish guys don't get it. Like the rabbis, the reason that they don't get it is because they're stuck on the lion part of it. And there is the Lion of Judah. There is the greatest, most powerful. God could move his hand and have a wall of fire turn everything to ash instantaneously. So the greatest power in the universe is also there. But the way that's being expressed for our benefit is in the Lamb. Someone who suffers, someone who dies, right? Comes back. The reason for that is our positioning. If we're taught by the Bible to only be the lion, it'll succeed sometimes. We can go and yell and smack people around. I mean, we can do that. But the problem is that's not the answer. The answer is to save people, not conquer and destroy people. So this is the switch that happens. Now, they don't get that. I mean, maybe Isaiah does, but nobody alive at that time understands that concept. We barely understand that concept in the 21st century. We can hardly get our head around the idea. Christ-like leadership, the first time that was introduced to me in seminary, what Christ-like leadership was, I was just like, how's that supposed to work in the kitchen, right? I'm used to beating people. Is that not a thing anymore? Just kidding. Sorry, Bobby. I'm just kidding. No, but the point is, that's the way it was. It was always very violent and loud. The way you got what you wanted was yelling, and they yelled back, yes, sir. Yeah, right? And that was it. It's always been like that for the most part. I mean, that's mostly how the military works. It's mostly how the kitchen works. It's mostly how government works. I mean, they pretend like they're not savages in Congress, but they are. They're savages. They'll yell at each other. If they get a chance, they'll go over the aisle and choke each other out. They get a chance, right? The lesson of Jesus is so hard for us to get our head around. And they're having that same trouble, you know, 2,700 years ago, trying to figure out how to deal with the Assyrians. They're like, well, let's go. If you got a bully on the playground, you go get a bigger bully. But that's not really what needs to happen. If you have a bully on the playground and you go get a bigger bully, what happens is, first of all, lots of violence so that everybody learns violence, which is a problem. Second of all, you're going to end up with a bully anyway and probably more bullies because other bullies are going to learn from those previous bullies' activities. What you need to do is sit down with the bully, figure out what's going on in their head and fix it. Help them come to the light. That doesn't necessarily work most of the time, right? But if you come at a bully sometimes as a friend, and this is forgiving your enemies, all the lessons of the Bible about all that stuff, sometimes you'll find out that that bully is bullied at home. Get that bully some help, and now you don't have a bully. This is the Jesus way. Jesus way is to sit down and have a talk. Sit at the well, talk to this lady. This lady's in major trouble. Not only has she had five husbands, but she's living with another guy already. She's not got a clue about what the world's really about. But she knows what he says is true. And then that she becomes a whole new creation, a whole different person. This is his way of doing things. Somebody say, hey, can you help my friend? He's broken up, he can't walk, or his legs are busted, or he's leprous, or whatever it is. And he'll say, do you want me to help him, or do you want me to help him? Because what he needs is more than just some walking around. Matter of fact, that might actually do more damage. You know what I mean? This is not how people think. And this is what they're doing in a much more militaristic, much more ancient way. That's what they're doing. But that's why Jesus is the final answer to everything. Because if you can get your head around it, the better you can get your head around it, the better off you are. Because I don't expect us to be 100% fully understanding of what Jesus means. But the more we can know that, the better off we can be. But these guys are doing the same kind of thing we tend to do, is trying to get a bigger bully. So in 8, now go, write it before them on a tablet and note it on a scroll, that it may be for time to come, forever and ever, that this is a rebellious people, lying children who will not hear the law of the Lord, who say to the seers, do not see, to the prophets, do not prophesy to us right things. Speak to us smooth things, prophecy deceits. Get out of the way, turn aside from the path, cause the Holy One of Israel to cease from before us. I know that's poetic and strange and sounds strange, but it's a very human reaction, right? If somebody's telling you the truth, you don't want to hear it, right? So you're like, just shut up and leave me alone. And they're being told the truth, but the truth doesn't match their idea. So they're telling the seers, hey, do not see, telling prophets, do not prophesy. And they want to hear smooth things. They want to hear easy listening truth. Now, this is funny because we're doing that still. There's a whole lot of churches where the whole point is easy listening church, where there's a really cute message and a really cute church and it's a really great coffee shop and all this other stuff, and it's just fun. And they give away Xboxes, you know, and it's great. And you have fun at church and you hear a cool message. And I'm not saying it's a wrong message, you know, about how your life can be great or how you know your life can be better and all these things. It's not a problem. In a way, it gets more people to pay attention, and some of those people are going to turn to the Word and become strong Christians. So I'm not mad at the lighter style of evangelism, the lighter style of churches in the modern world. But that's basically a version of this. It's sort of the light. It's like truth light. You know, we can talk about the Bible in so many different ways. And one of the ways we can do it is to dig deep into things that are hard. You know, talk about the struggle of the world and what it means and where it's from and how to overcome it. And deep, dark, difficult things. But we can also talk about lighthearted stuff. You know, we could talk about some of the fun, interesting things and focus on, you know, overcoming. We can use, you know, simple, they're not inaccurate metaphors, but simplistic. We can take David and Goliath, and we can talk about David being the little guy and him, you know, fighting Goliath, who's the big scary guy, in a stone and killing him, and how awesome it is. And we can have a message about that's you and your life, and, you know, you can do that. That's a true message. It's fine. But it's like truth light. It doesn't deal with who David was. Doesn't deal with who Goliath was. Doesn't deal with the reason that the other guys around him weren't doing anything. There's all these deep studies that you can do of that same exact scene. So you can take that same passage and you can do the light version. Little guy fighting big guy. You know, whoever's playing football against Tom Brady today, right? You can connect it all and make it light and happy, right? Or you can say, why? Why was David delivering lunch? What does that mean? Why were his brothers, who were all bigger and stronger than him, not able to move? What is the strength of God? What does true belief mean? How does deep, true understanding of who God is in your life alter you into something completely unstoppable, right? There's a deeper analysis. Because David's strength isn't coming from an interesting moment or a cute idea. David's strength is simple. He is a flawed, awful human being, just like all of us. His strength is coming from the fact that he is totally reliant upon the Lord, that he completely gets it. He's one of the closest humans to what Jesus said about, if you truly believed, you could move that mountain. You could tell that mountain to go jump in the sea, and that mountain to go jump in the sea. Because we are connected to God and we're living in his universe, the closer we get to him, the more power we can move in. So the fact is, if we truly got it, like Jesus level got it, then we could just get rid of that mountain, because we would pray and the prayers would be instantaneously recognized by the universal God and it would be instantaneously accomplished. And we don't, but we, none of us can achieve that goal. But the closer you get to it, the more power you can move in. So David is an example of somebody that's just flawed and has all kinds of problems. But he's so close to God. He gets it as much as a human being can get it, you know, basically. He's so close that he looks around and he's like, why are these guys scared? This is God. This big dude over here, it looks big to a human being, but not to God. To God, he's a little pipsqueak. This doesn't make any sense. Why are these guys are supposed to be the army of God, and they just don't understand who God is. I'm going to walk out there, and then the guy in charge of these guys is going to try to give me this amazing armor, and I can't even really fit it, okay? I don't need any armor. I don't need any weapons. I don't need anything. I got like a rock. How about that? Would that make you guys feel better if I had a rock? I mean, he really doesn't even need a rock. He knows that he could just walk out there and point at him, and Goliath will have a heart attack and die. That's where he is. Everybody else is like, ah! And David's like, did nobody point at him? Because you could point at him. You understand that, right? All right, give me the rock for a second. Look, you guys need to pay attention because he's dead. You know, he's like that guy on TikTok, like where he points to stuff and he goes, hey, that's David. David points at the dead Goliath, turns around, trips, and goes, right? that guy is so famous. He started off basically homeless and now he's really famous. He was out of work, I think, during COVID. Started doing that. So he's hilarious. Anyway, that's David that day. But the point is that they're still doing it. Like, you would think that when David did what he did, which was now 300-400 years ago, right, at the time of Isaiah, you would think that everybody would get it. Like, okay, you saw that. Then God said David was going to be king. And there's no, that didn't make any sense. But then David's king. Everybody knows King David, most powerful, important king ever, right? Everybody's like, yeah. Why is nobody paying attention? And I'm not trying to mock them, because I do the same thing. I'm forever forgetting what's going on. Like, I'll be doing whatever, and I'll be like, oh, I forgot to pray. Like, how did I drive out here in a snowy storm and forget to pray? Because I know. I mean, every single day, I know where I am and who I am and who God is, like, in some form. And I know, okay, I'm going to pray now. I know this. And I still forget. So I can't be too harsh on the Israelites, because I might have gone and sent a guy to Egypt and talked to Egypt too, right? I can't be too harsh. But God says, write it down. This is hilarious. It's like, okay. And you need to go down the street, three streets, take a left, go down two more to the light, take a right over there, that's where the drugstore is. Maybe you need to write this down, which basically means you're probably too dumb to remember this. So now you've proven over and over again that you're too dumb to remember it, because I've done it over and over again. I did it with Egypt. I did it with David. I did it with Joshua. I mean, how many times I got to march people around a wall and have the wall fall down, or have a kid with a rock kill a giant? I mean, how many times do I have to do this? You still don't get it. So write it down this time. Write it down. That's what Isaiah is. The whole book of Isaiah is, write it down this time so that people will remember that this giant empire was coming, and I said, just turn to the Lord, and people didn't listen, but Hezekiah will, and then boom, problem solved. And it's going to be a major one. It's going to be a David moment. It's going to be even bigger than David, even bigger than Moses, because 185,000 Assyrians are about to drop dead in their sleep. So, if this doesn't do it for all time, I don't know what to say. So write it down. He says, write it on a tablet, write it on a scroll, you know, record it every way you can so this rebellious people get it. Therefore, thus says the Holy One of Israel, when you get one of those things, when it's like, okay, therefore, you know, that's where you're like, okay, pay attention. And I can just see Isaiah saying that too. I don't know what it looked like. It's too long. It's 2,700 years. We don't know. We don't even know what the couch looked like, really. So, I mean, I don't know exactly what the scene is like. Because we see it as all this stone. And the reason we see it as all this stone is because that's what's left. So when we do archaeology, we have these stone buildings. So we think everybody's walking around on stones and stone buildings. And they might have been. But I don't know what it looked like. I don't know how Isaiah was getting this message across. I know that he talks to the kings. I don't know if he's giving giant speeches on a big platform and everybody comes around. I don't know if it's in front of the temple. I don't know if he just tells it to people. I don't know if they hand out the stuff he's writing down. I don't know how it looks. But I can just see him going, okay, to like a big court of people. Therefore, thus says the Lord, the Holy One of Israel, because you despise the word, this word, and trust in oppression and perversity, and rely on them. Therefore, this iniquity shall be to you like a breach ready to fall, a bulge in a high wall, whose breaking comes suddenly in an instant. And he shall break it like the breaking of a potter's vessel, which is broken to pieces. He shall not spare, so there shall not be found among his fragments a shard to take fire from the hearth. It's a great image. You've got a pottery vessel broken so bad that you can't find a piece enough to go get a little coal from the fire to bring over and move the coal. And you can't even find a piece big enough to do that. That's a pretty hard break. But also, it means you're not going to be able to move the fire. It means you're going to have a cold place where you can't warm it. A shard to take the fire from the hearth or to take the water from the cistern. That's like the broken pot, and you have a little piece of the broken pot and you're trying to drink out of it. So you start off with a beautiful pot. It's beautiful. It's decorated. You can fill it with coals and move it over here. You can rinse it out. You can use it to carry water. It's completely useful. You have access to this. But then you don't take care of it, and it breaks. And it breaks so bad that you can't even find pieces, because you're going to turn around and start looking for it. Once you have this beautiful pot and this beautiful tray and all these wonderful things, but you let that part of the building, you know, you didn't do the maintenance you need to do on the beams, that part of the building collapsed, it crushed all those pottery pieces. Now you're looking around for that pottery, and it's not there. And you can't even find a piece of it to use to do part of what. So you were given an entire giant jug of water, and now you're thirsty. You're going back looking for it, and it's not there because you let it be destroyed. That's the imagery that we're getting. They have it all. They can do whatever they want. If they really paid attention to God and really did what he wanted them to do and really listened to them, they would never be in danger. There would be so much, you know, protection, and so many things would happen, but they would never be in danger. But unfortunately, they're not doing it like that. For thus says the Lord God, the Holy One of Israel. So he said the Holy One of Israel twice in a row with sections of information. In returning in rest, you shall be saved. In quietness and confidence shall be your strength. But you would not. So if you just return to him, you have rest. You'll be saved. If you just be quiet and confident, you'll have strength. But you would not. And you said, no, for we will flee on horses. Therefore, you shall flee. And we will ride on swift horses. Therefore, those who pursue you shall be swift. 1,000 shall flee at the threat of one. At the threat of five, you shall flee till you are left as a pole on top of a mountain as a banner on a hill. So this is the image. Let's just stop there for today. Let's take this banner on the hill and just think about this for a second. A banner on a hill. So just imagine this. Imagine there was an army encamped here. On the highest hill, the army put up a flag. Okay? They have their tents, they have their weapons and everything. The enemy's coming, so they flee, and all that's left is this banner on this hill. Now, this image is really sad because it means that they had this land, that they had this conquered, that they had an army. It means that they had a banner, but the banner is tattered, and the banner is on this hill, and there's no one around it. So it represents the power they could have or should have. There's still a banner on the hill, which means they could have been there. And it says a pole on the top of a mountain. It's like you're given everything, but you don't get it. So you flee. And then it's like, you know, I'm reminded of this movie. There's this old cheesy horror movie called The Fog. And in this movie, or The Mist or something like that. Anyway, in this movie, there's like this, I don't know, zombie apocalypse or something going on. Anyway, everybody's fleeing. And there's this people that are in this car, and the car breaks down, and everybody's hopeless. And if you get caught, you get turned into a zombie or whatever. And I can't really remember all the details. But there's this couple left in this car. And they're discussing the hopelessness of the situation. And they're in this, like, fog. And the way this movie ends is there's people coming through the fog. So they figure it's the bad guys. And so he, like, shoots her and gets ready to shoot himself when the army gets there. The guys who are coming to rescue them is who it is. And you're like, oops. oops. It's like Romeo and Juliet. You know, you wake up and the other person appears to be dead, so you kill yourself. Then they wake up and you've killed yourself, so they kill themselves. It's like no one has any faith in these situations. You know, if you turn to God, in none of these situations does anyone turn to God and pray, right? It's not part of Romeo and Juliet. Or The Fog, or whatever, The Mist, whatever the movie is. But if you were to turn to God and pray, you would get a message, hey, hang on, they're coming right now. Or check the pulse. You're like, oh, you're alive, right? Or, oh, that's the army, right? You got to fight, you know, you got to have faith. And the abandoned banner on the hill, or the guys running to Egypt, or the people abandoning their post as the Assyrians come, are all examples of people who don't have faith. You know, and I get it. I'm not mad at them. It's hard to stand there on a post and see a giant army and think, okay, we got this. You know, like me and George, we totally have this. That's hard. I get it. But that's the whole point. God's saying, if you will just turn to me, I'll start to give you the information, but because you're reacting in a physical world, in a physical way, the physical world's going to react to you. So because you think, oh, we need swift horses, they're going to have swift horses too. You know, you understand what he's trying to say? What if you thought, well, there is no horses, we don't need to flee, then they wouldn't have horses. So, you know, that's like a metaphor, but you're like creating your life where you're counting on all these things. And that means you're going to get those things. It's like if you were praying for money and you prayed for, you had a big bill that was due and you prayed for, $1,000 to cover the bill and you got $1,000 to cover the bill. Or you prayed for your house to be paid off. So you got a couple hundred thousand dollars and your house was paid off. Or you prayed for $1 million and you got $1 million. And you don't realize till afterwards that you could have just had $1 billion and none of this would have mattered. But there's a $1 billion. But you were too busy trying to get the $1,000 to pay the bill to realize that in your backyard there was a vein of gold. If you would have been listening to God, God would have said, walk down the block to where the creek is. And you would have walked down the block to where the creek is, and there would have been a pick laying there. You would have found a pick. And you would have walked around and talked to your neighbors about whose pick it was, but no one claimed the picks. So you'd have been like, I guess I have a pick. And then instead of worrying about the bills, you went out back to have a barbecue because you got a steak. Because God has provided these beautiful steaks in this grill that works. So you go out there and you're grilling, and you're hanging around waiting for the steaks. Unless you're playing with the pick in the backyard and you uncover gold. And you're like, take it down to see your friend. Because he's a Christian. You want to talk about Isaiah. And you're talking about Isaiah. And he's like, this is actual gold, man. And it's like, I think there's more of it. And now you're a billionaire. You didn't do anything except just listen to God and hang out. But when you were too busy working trying to solve the first problem, you missed that whole thing. And that's what's happening here. That army is going to be destroyed at the wall of Jerusalem. They never have to even get there. They never even have to get there. God is capable of doing anything. He can change that direction. He can have them attacked from another direction by another army. He can have them all get sick. He can have the weather change. Anything can happen. Heck, the guy whose idea it was to come there could die. There's literally a million ways God could just solve the problem. But you're trying to mass an army and talking to Egypt about helping. If you want to do it this way, you can do it this way, but you're gonna fail. So that's the message. And that's why this passage is so long. This particular chapter, Isaiah 30, is sort of a bridge between all the stuff that we've been talking about, which is dealing with the physical world and how you really need to be dealing with stuff. It's mind-boggling to me to think about all the things we probably missed out on because we probably weren't paying attention. God was probably nudging us in a different direction, and we probably missed it. So we're dealing with whatever we're dealing with. He'll still help us through whatever problem that is, but it didn't need to happen. It's sort of like Abraham taking on, him and Sarah are supposed to have a kid, but it's taken so long. Man, maybe God is wrong. Maybe we missed something. So let's have our own kid. Maybe that's what God meant for us to do, is go and make it happen. And they created we're still getting messed up because of that decision. It's still in play. Kind of mind-boggling. So anyway, that's the lesson, and we're going to keep going with chapter 30 next time. We're stopping at the 17. But that imagery from all this poetic stuff, about that lonely pole, that lonely banner on top of that hill. I mean, all that stuff is really important. And it's important to us. It's important to them. It's important for all time. All you got to do is pitch in. How many times are we going to talk about this, right? This is Adam and Eve's problem. All you need to do is listen to God. You got the whole garden. There's one thing. We can't even do that. We can't even not eat that one fruit, man. Like, God's like, you've got apples and oranges and cherries and pears and bananas and pineapples, and just don't eat kiwi fruit. We're like, but kiwi fruit's so green and it's got these little black spots. It's so cute. Like, literally every other fruit. But kiwis are fuzzy. That's humans, man. It's just humans since the very beginning. It's our flaw. So what do we learn? Just We need to, on a daily basis, be turning to God and trying to hear what He's got for us, trying to go the way He needs us to go. Because more likely, more often than not, that's going to save us from a whole lot of worries and a whole lot of trouble. Worry is one of our big things in our lives because worry is what hasn't happened yet. And we're so busy worrying that we don't basically just listen to God and what He says, don't worry. Because this is the most worrisome human, like one of the most worrisome times humans have ever had. Jerusalem's been established for over 300 years. A giant army of almost 200,000 people, maybe more, is coming. This is the most worried you can get. So God's using it as an example for us. Well, just rely on me, and everything's going to be okay. Because we keep hearing that message, and we keep not doing it for like thousands of years. And since the very beginning, we've been hearing the same message. So I think that's the point that we're on now. We're going to keep going. And every single time they do that, they talk about that here, there's hope. You could return and rest and be saved. There's always that hope. God is always leaving that kernel of hope, that seed, that light on in the darkness. It's always on. It's like the eternal flame. There's always a light on, no matter how dark it is, no matter how hard it is to see. It might be way over there, but there's a lighthouse. Even in the worst storm, on the worst sea, in the worst night, there's still a lighthouse. We just got to look for the light. All right, let's pray. Lord, thank You for this day. Thank You for this time to come together. Thank You for Your word. We honor and glorify Your name. We praise who You are. And we thank You for this time. Bless everyone here. Bless their hearts and their minds as they draw closer to You. Give them opportunities to grow closer to You. Protect our families and our homes and our businesses and our finances. Protect our kids and our pets and our vehicles, and just keep us safe in our lives. And let us know in our hearts that You're the one keeping us safe so that we can rest in You and thereby draw closer to You, learn more of You, pray more, study more, and draw closer to You. All we want is more of You. That's why we're here. That's what this message today is about. We want to ask Your blessing on everyone coming here. Bring people into church today. Bless the messages and the worship that we'll have. Give everyone a chance to know more of You and draw closer to You. We thank You so much, and we ask for more of You all the time. All of Your protection, all of Your blessing, all the time, Lord. You're what we turn to in all times. Thank You, thank You, thank You. We love You with all our hearts. And we pray all these things in the mighty and unstoppable name of Jesus Christ. Amen.